Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we are going to travel. And there will be lush and not so lush.
Yeah.
And all kinds of interesting.
And hot and cold and wet and dry.
Yeah, no kidding.
Seven continents worth.
No kidding. Yeah. Pretty cool. I think it's a nice juxtaposition of two very cool experiences. We're going to talk with Terry Baldino first.
Interesting guy. He is the chief naturalist at Death Valley. Which is a good place not to be.
Not to be right now.
Yeah, but I suspect, and when we talk to Terry, we're going to find out that there are actually some reasons to go there certain times of the year. And
sure.
I've never wanted to go except through it real fast, but I always thought I wanted to go there just to say I'd been.
Yeah. And I bet you there's more nuances to it than we realize.
Oh, yeah.
So look forward to learning a little bit more about Death Valley and maybe shattering some of the preconceptions and misconceptions that people have about
it. And also, this is interesting to me. What about plants allows them to live in that environment?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does it take as a plant to survive 120, 130
and
degrees?
What does it tell us after
all?
Huh.
And why are we complaining?
Yeah, why are we complaining? Exactly. Miss Sarah Oldfield, she has written a book called Great Botanic Gardens of the World. It includes about 60 botanic gardens around the world.
Yeah.
She's also the Secretary General of Botanic Gardens Conservation International, which has their headquarters there at Kew Gardens in England. And they, you know, they're kind of like a clearinghouse of information and a link facilitator, if you will, among the many botanic gardens of the world. So
yeah, we should call England at least once a month just to hear them talk.
Yes, of course.
That alone makes it worthwhile.
Yeah. Right. And always good information, certainly.
Yeah.
So.
And this really is, it's a good subject, a good topic these days, especially because of the...
It's one of those life lists, perhaps. You could get this book and start ticking off the great botanic gardens of the world and do a bit of traveling.
That's exactly what I'm planning on doing.
That's what I was thinking. This is perfect for you, Bob, because now that you're moving into your retirement years, maybe you'll get to travel to more of these botanic gardens.
You forgot to say aging gracefully.
You are aging gracefully as well.
Oh.
All right, okay. What's going on in your garden, Bob?
Well, a couple things. One, my Japanese anemones are starting to bloom, and we often talk about these later in the year, even in the fall, but it's one of my favorite late summer fall plants. It's got this beautiful foliage and this nice, tall, kind of airy stalk. And this beautiful pink and white flower, there's whirlwind, and there's a bunch of other kind. Japanese anemones are just a great late summer plant.
Yeah, and we've often talked about them because they're underused.
Exactly.
Because when people are shopping in the spring, they're not blooming, so they don't buy them.
I don't understand it. They need to be.
But they are great plants.
And the other thing is, I'm amazed how my foliage plants, the spring bloomers, you know, the heucheras and the heucherellas and the brunera and those kind of things, the foliage is really holding up very well this year.
Our summer hasn't been that bad so far.
No, it hasn't been.
We've been really lucky.
So that's another reminder to people. You see these things and you think, oh, they're going to bloom in the spring and forget it. Well, you can have this color pattern, this quilt of color, all year long with a little work.
And those are typically sort of shade tolerant, too.
Yes.
So they're fabulous additions to a shade garden to sort of brighten it up in terms of, you know, just adding different textures and
so
colors.
So it's been a good garden year so far. But
the
wishiest state.
Keep our
what's
fingers
up?
Crossed.
Well, let me add first before you get into that. We actually went to Janine's last week, folks, and we did some jamming, but we saw the chickens. They're just like little pets. They follow you around. They eat. They were eating blueberries out of our fingers.
That's right. You fed them blueberries.
They were just charming.
We've kind of gotten in the habit
polite.
Of sitting down with them in the yard, in the shade, in the grass in the evenings.
Yeah.
And they come around and we'll feed them like little, you know, just pick grass or clover and feed them. They love the clover. They're so sweet.
They're user-friendly chickens.
It just kills
unlike
me.
Unlike my farm chickens and my youth.
I know. They really are sweet.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
But beyond that,
I do, and I also showed Bob my cardoon. I had talked about the cardoon earlier in the season.
Can you talk about that on the air?
I showed you my cardoon.
Oh, my God.
But we talked about the cardoon because it came back for me this year. Typically doesn't come back.
That's right.
It's not cold hardy. In a normal winter, but I had left all the foliage there, so we figured it just insulated it well enough, right? So it's the second year, it had big, strong roots, it grew, and it was in the garden long, you know, it's been in the garden for 2 years now, so it's been blooming, and it looks like a humongous thistle, basically, but it's beautiful. They're extremely nectar rich, and Bob and Brad were able to see with their own eyes like an orgy of insects in each of these blooms. I mean, literally, they're like digging... down one bloom is about how big do you think? Like maybe 2 inches across?
Yeah.
And their little purple kind of tubular, you know, thistly-like things sticking up. And then you look into the center and there are honeybees and like little wasps and little good beneficial flies, not annoying flies. And that was one of the reasons we wanted to put it in the garden, because it was a plant that attracted beneficial insects. And honey, it is doing its job.
So if the listeners want to grow cardoon next year, what do they do?
So we bought seeds originally, started them from seeds, and then we put the plants out. And then I recommend, from my own sort of lazy, haphazard, happy mistake,
right,
don't clean up the foliage after the foliage gets killed back, and let it just lay there and hope that it blooms for you in the second year. I think places like, you know, Thienemann's Herbs and Perennials, herb specialty places, typically will have the plants for sale as well. But to get them to bloom, you need them earlier in the season. You need some age on them, too. So that's,
well, it's just fun to say, I've got some cardoon in my garden.
Yeah, it's a really dramatic plant, isn't it?
And a great word.
Yeah.
Cardoon.
And the good insects sure do like it.
And speaking of beautiful things in tough places.
Yeah.
We're about to visit Death Valley.
Which is a beautiful place and a tough place both.
If it was named Life Valley, nobody'd go.
No kidding. We'll find out what Death Valley's all about and how it got its name too, Bob.
We're going to speak with Terry Baldino. He's chief naturalist at Death Valley National Park, which is a 3.6 million acre park located on the California-Nevada border. He's with us today to talk about the park and what in the world can live there and why, including the park rangers. Terry, welcome to Homegrown.
Hi, well, glad to be here.
I've been to quite a few of the national parks, and most of the naturalists and the rangers actually like where they are and wanted to be there, and you're in Death Valley, man. Can you explain that?
Yeah, that's a good question. My mom is still asking me that, believe it or not. It's one of those places that, as a kid, I'd always heard about because my grandparents came here every winter, just because the winters are so mild and beautiful. And living in Colorado, they escaped the winters and came here. And so we would see tons of photographs every year of Death Valley. And as I grew up, I thought, I don't know if I could do this. And then a certain announcement for a certain job came open, and I applied. And the first thing my wife said is, are you nuts? And then when I got the job and I was telling my parents, my mom, her first reaction was, oh, my God, what did you do wrong? Why are they sending you there? It's like, well, no, I applied. And they really thought I was nuts.
It's not a punishment.
It really is a beautiful place.
Huh. Let's talk about that. What forces of nature and geology created Death Valley, and what's there, and what are some of the temperature extremes, maybe?
Death Valley is basically a zone that was created primarily by earth tectonics, earthquakes, fault zones, for the most part. And actually, when you think of Death Valley, you have to think of a series of valleys and mountains, each one separated by a different series of fault lines. And, of course, you think of California, you think of earthquakes. You need to think of Death Valley in the same way. But over millions of years, as these fault lines have been shifting and moving around, blocks of Earth have been dropping, and other blocks of Earth have been moving upward. So what we have here in Death Valley is not a true valley like you would see in Kentucky, for example, where a river has cut through the mountains and creating a valley.
Mm-hmm.
No river created Death Valley as we see it today. It was literally a chunk of ground that dropped while the surrounding chunks of ground rose up in the air, creating the valley.
So, Terry, can you guys monitor still that this is occurring?
Yes. Actually, geologists have been putting in monitoring equipment for decades here in the park, and they say that faulting, that dropping of the valley floor is still occurring, probably an inch every century or so.
Mm-hmm.
But the amazing thing is the surrounding mountains, during heavy rains, and we do get them occasionally, are eroding the surrounding mountains at almost the same rate.
So it keeps the scale, huh?
Kind of status quo.
Pretty much.
That's kind of fun.
That's really cool.
Well, talk some about the extremes. I mean, is it the lowest point in the United States?
It is. Death Valley is actually, Death Valley proper, is 282 feet below sea level, which makes us actually the lowest point in North America.
Huh.
And in the world, I think we're ranked number 7. The Dead Sea is obviously the deepest in the world.
Right.
But, yes, because of that dropping, faulting process, if we were to ever have the coastline break off and disappear, we could see an ocean flood back in here, and certain properties in the park could be, you know, beachfront properties.
Prices go up.
Then you won't seem so crazy after all,
right? That's right.
Well, how tall are the mountains, and what are the temperature extremes?
And that's the other thing that I think makes Death Valley unique is a lot of folks don't think of Death Valley as having mountains. And we have mountains that are over 11,000 feet high. So when you're standing at what we call Badwater Basin at 282 feet below sea level, you're looking at an elevation change of over 2 miles
Wow.
to the top at Telescope Peak at 11,000 feet. So with that elevation change, we have tremendous changes in different environments. From, of course, the salt pan valley floor to almost subalpine environment at the top of Telescope Peak.
Mm-hmm. So how did it get its moniker Death Valley? I mean, did people die trying to get through there? Or?
Yes and no. It is really unfortunate that the name Death Valley was applied to such a place which actually has quite a bit of life.
Mm-hmm.
But back in 1849, when the huge gold rush to the California Sierras to get the gold was going on, there was an intrepid group that left the Provo, Utah area late in the spring, which meant that they were probably not going to get to the Sierras until the winter hit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you remember the Donner Party, that's the last thing they wanted to do was run into the Sierras with snow.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided to take a southern route, which they felt would avoid the Sierras and still get them in up into the Sierras in time to make sure that there was some gold left over. Unfortunately, they were going into uncharted territory, and a bunch of them, of course, stumbled into Death Valley. In their trials of getting in and then, of course, getting out of the valley, there was one group of them, as they were leaving this area, looked back across Death Valley and, you know, were saying, goodbye, Death Valley, because they really thought that was where they were going to end up dying.
Mm-hmm.
Now, believe it or not, out of the couple hundred that trekked across here in 1849 and in the winter of 1849-1850, only one person died.
Aww.
What actually happened after that was when everyone got to the California gold fields and found that the gold had pretty much been eaten up, then they rushed back into Death Valley because all of a sudden these 49ers had stories of, well, we saw gold, but we were, you know, trying to save our lives, and we left.
Uh-huh.
That's when a lot of the deaths occurred because they arrived in the summer to find this gold.
And was there ever any gold in Death Valley?
There was gold.
Okay.
There were several gold mining towns here. They didn't last long. Mm-hmm. The most profitable mineral, of course, that came out of Death Valley was borax.
Huh. Interesting.
Well, going back to some of the ancient cultures, were there ever civilizations there 10, 20,000 years ago of permanent residents?
Actually, there was. Even today, we have a Native American tribe here, the Timbisha Shoshone Indians, that feel their ancestors go back 10 to 20,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, archaeological evidence indicates that, you know, 10 to 20,000 years ago, the environment was quite different than what we see today.
Sure.
It was wetter. There was actually a lake in the bottom of Death Valley, not a dry salt pan.
Mm-hmm.
But as the climate changed, so did the Native Americans' use of the surrounding lands. Today's tribes, typically, if we hadn't been around, would probably still be using the land pretty much as their ancestors did, using the valley floor during the winter months, using the upper mountain elevations during the summer months.
Mm-hmm. So it actually is a really kind of a fabulous place because it has everything you need depending on what time of the year it is, and just make sure you're in the right place at the right time of the year.
Oh, exactly. If you're prepared, even during the dead of summer, with plenty of water and a good working car and know where you want to go, you can still enjoy Death Valley. It's just like me trying to go to Minnesota in a blizzard in dead of winter. Maybe if I'm prepared, it would be worth it, but I don't know.
Yeah.
What is the record temperature there?
The record temperature was set back in 1913, actually July 10th, at 134 degrees.
Hmm. And what's it there today?
Today, like I said, we have kind of a cold front moving through, so today's high is only predicted to be about 111.
Oh, not so bad.
Snowball.
Okay, Terry, let's talk about some of the flora and fauna that we would actually find at Death Valley. Shall we start in the valley floor? Probably not as much in the valley floor if it's salt basin.
Exactly.
Salt
the valley
basin.
Floor is going to be the most sparse, in part because of the real lack of precipitation and the intense heat, and you're right about the other thing being the very saline soils that are on the valley floor. But we do have plants here. The most common one is the creosote bush,
mm-hmm.
And that's probably kind of our signature plant throughout the Mojave Desert, and it's not something that you see huge forests of. They are well spaced apart to take advantage of what little moisture is out there. And then intermixed with that, you might even see things like desert holly and other plants like that that can survive in that saline soil. Mm-hmm. But you're right, there isn't a lot on the valley floor itself.
Now, how do they survive? What's the unique physiology of the creosote plant that enables it to live in that kind of surroundings?
The creosote is an amazing plant. It's extremely well adapted to this kind of environment. It doesn't really send out deep root systems. It's fairly shallow, and that's one reason why the plants are so spread apart, so that they don't interfere with collecting of water that another plant is going to need.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, the leaves themselves are very waxy and very narrow, which again helps to reduce that evaporation during periods when there's absolutely no moisture coming through at all. So it doesn't want to lose a lot to evaporation like you would find with a large, say, maple leaf that just is big and floppy and exposed to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that combination, and at the same time, if conditions get bad, it'll actually start to drop its leaves and turn a little brown, but you get it just a little bit of moisture and it greens up very quickly.
Mm-hmm. So how often does moisture arrive? When's the rainy season?
Our rainy season, actually, believe it or not, is coming up now.
Mm-hmm.
You see, July and August is, we actually have two periods of the year where we tend to get rains. July and August is one, and then the other is usually in February.
Mm-hmm.
And the rain, typically our average precip is about 1.9 inches.
Wow. A year?
A year.
So it's not like monsoon rains, it's just like a little rain here and there, maybe.
It can be monsoon rains in the sense that it comes in huge downpours.
Uh-huh.
Now, you have to remember, 1.9 inches is what we record at the main park headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
That's where our official weather station is. But you can sit out here on any day during July and August and see a thunderstorm 15, 20 miles away,
uh-huh.
and you can tell it's probably dumping 2 or 3 inches of rain in that one spot.
Uh-huh.
But the rest of it, of the park, is not seeing any rain at all.
So does the geography of the place dictate that some places get more rain than others in that kind of limited range? Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Like, okay, pop-up shower over there, but we never get pop-up showers over here kind of thing?
Yes, exactly. And again, it's this series of mountain ranges that I was telling you about.
Mm-hmm.
The largest, of course, mountain range that really influences our weather is the Sierra Mountains. They're, 11 to 14,000 foot peaks, and it forces a lot of the moisture coming off the Pacific to dump onto them. Then as they creep up over the Sierras, they've got two or three other more mountain ranges before they actually physically get to Death Valley. By then, those clouds have been wrenched dry of any moisture.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times what we see are the clouds, and they see lightning, but it's high elevation. We don't see much in the way of actual precipitation.
Right. Hmm. Dries up.
Now, I think I read you're a 3.6 million acre park. Are parts of it more green than others near the mountains, near the top of the mountains?
Exactly. At the higher elevations, like Telescope Peak, we do have a montane environment where we have pinyon and juniper, and even the ancient bristlecone pine trees, which can grow up to and live up to 2,500 to 3,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. We were talking earlier about some of the seeds and their viability. They can last for 20 or 25 years without any water at all?
Yes. One of the things that Death Valley is somewhat known for is the spring wildflowers, and that's if we have sufficient rains. And we will get torrential rains here about every 25 to 50 years, and that's when the wildflower spectacular really happens.
Huh.
In the meantime, between those bursts, those seeds can lay dormant for decades before conditions are just right.
Terry, do those seeds, have they adapted in a way where they have to be dormant for a number of years before they'll germinate?
No, not
okay.
really.
Okay.
The conditions just have to be correct.
Mm-hmm.
The neat thing about these seeds is a lot of them are super coated with a very thick, waxy surface.
Mm-hmm.
And if it gets a little bit of rain, it's like it knows it's enough not to wear off that waxy coating and not to germinate, because it's just not enough rain to survive.
Mm-hmm.
If we get sufficient rains where it actually has the opportunity to wear off and dissolve that waxy coating, then it's like, okay, there's sufficient moisture in the soil, I'm going to bloom and produce seeds.
Huh. Are there any small, viable towns within Death Valley Park now?
Actually, Death Valley, because it is a national park, there are actually no towns within the boundaries of the park. We do have, though, a private landowner called Zantera Parks and Resorts right smack dab in the middle of the park, and they own a private resort there that runs hotels, motels, restaurants, and so that's probably the primary area where folks kind of get their first taste of Death Valley.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what are some of the wilder and crazier animals we're going to find in that?
Yeah, we're not quite Yellowstone. don't come here expecting to see a big bison herd, run across in front of your car.
Anything would survive.
But we do see a lot of lizards here. And in the evenings, the most common one, which is really a neat animal that's well adapted to this environment, is the kangaroo rat. Huh. And it's a rat-sized rodent that has really long tail, big hind feet, big brown eyes. Hmm. Well adapted to running around in the evenings when it's cooler, and it doesn't need to drink open water. It can actually get all of its moisture from the seeds that it eats.
Huh. Wow. This is neat. So when global warming gets here full bore, you guys will be ready.
Well, at least some of the animals and plants will be, that's for sure.
I mean, can you tell has Death Valley become warmer? Has it become drier? Is it sort of
how would you know itself?
And how would you know?
That's an excellent question. And actually, we've got researchers currently working at seeing what impacts climate change is really going to have on Death Valley. Keep in mind, all the plants and animals that survive here naturally are already living on the edge of survival.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And if conditions get any worse, we have the potential of even losing species of desert plants and animals because conditions are just going to be too beyond their capabilities to survive here. So we do have researchers right now in the park trying to figure out, are we seeing a change in climate? And we have been collecting weather data here, like I said, since the early 1900s. So we've got over 100 years' worth of weather data already. And what's interesting is what folks seem to be noticing is that when we do have the intense summer heat, it's staying intense longer.
Okay.
So we're not seeing, 134 degree temperatures every day now, but we are seeing the 120 plus temperature days over longer periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean for the plants and animals? That's what a lot of this future research hopefully will kind of help point out for us.
But you do get a lot of tourists. I think I read you get 750,000, and I imagine January is kind of pleasant out there.
January is spectacular, and it's our quietest month.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone thinks it's too cold.
How cold is it?
And it'll get down to freezing at night, mid-60s during the day. But
sounds
I think
perfect.
The biggest thing is January is also the days are the shortest. So if you really want to go out exploring, you really have to plan your trips carefully because your daylight hours are so short and this park is just so big to get around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So is it that typical sort of desert experience where it can get very cold at night, but then warm up pretty significantly during the day, such a vast fluctuation from daytime and nighttime temperatures in the winter?
Yes, actually during the winter months. Now, during the summer months, that doesn't happen.
Okay.
Death Valley, because of its depth, really holds and retains the heat from the day. So you can actually step out at night at 1 o'clock in the morning and it's still 110 degrees
out. Oh, man.
Wow.
There's just something wrong with stepping out, figuring it's got to be cool, and it's not.
And there's probably no breeze coming through that valley either, huh?
And even if there is,
it's hot.
Like you said, sticking your head in an oven. It's hot.
Well, Terry, thank you. And your mom was right, wasn't she?
I think it sounds great.
No, it does sound great. And
we'll come visit you in January.
January, you betcha.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Good time to come.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Terry.
Hey, you're welcome.
Terry Baldino was chief naturalist at Death Valley National Park. For more information on Terry or the flora and fauna in the park, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, the great botanic gardens of the world. Sarah Oldfield hits just about every continent. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And from Death Valley to the great botanic gardens of the world.
It's going to be fun. Yeah, I think we counted up earlier, we've been to less than 10.
Yeah.
But it's a goal.
It's a goal.
And it was kind of fun to read her book anyway, because actually, I've been in New Zealand and went to two of them in New Zealand and one in Ireland. And mm-hmm. I said, well, I'm on the way.
Yeah.
I'm just one lottery winning short of seeing some of the great gardens in the world.
And she includes 60 in this book, but of course there's way more than 60 around the world. So hopefully maybe we've been to some of those that haven't been included.
Right.
All right. Sarah Oldfield's joining us now. She's the author of Great Botanic Gardens of the World. The book addresses the important work botanic gardens do. Their diversity is vast, and you may be surprised how many great ones there really are out there. Sarah is the Secretary General of Botanic Gardens Conservation International. And Sarah, we want to thank you for your time and welcome you to Homegrown.
Hi, it's good to be talking to you.
Great, thanks. By definition, what is a botanic garden?
Well, a botanic garden is a garden that has a documented collection of plants and has a scientific or a conservation role, as well as providing a great place for the general public to visit. So mm-hmm. It's basically the plants that are in the garden are documented and databased so that they are part of a living collection.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sarah, does size matter, so to speak? Do you have to have 1,000 acres or 100 acres to qualify as a botanic garden?
Oh, no, I don't think size is very important at all. I think it's really the purpose of the collection and also to have some sort of vision and mission of what the plants are in the gardens for. So mm-hmm. Some of the very smallest gardens in Madagascar and places like that are beautifully maintained and have a very important scientific and conservation role.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose, too, since we're looking, around the world, that some places may have more or less resources in terms of land and, management and other types of things as well that might influence size.
That's right, and I think that's one of the amazing things about botanic gardens, certainly that I found when I was researching my book. I mean, there's such a great diversity. Mm-hmm. There's a new botanic garden that's been developed in the middle of a highway interchange in Istanbul in Turkey, which is doing fantastic work.
Wow.
So if we look back historically, were there periods in history that were more encouraging for these types of institutions, and why? I think of the Victorians and some of the great botanic, gardens in England and the glass houses and that sort of thing. I mean, were there other periods in history that really sort of pushed for cataloging, plants and researching them?
Well, yes, I think the earliest botanic gardens as we know them now developed in Europe in the 16th century and predominantly in Italy, places like Padua and Pisa and Bologna and Rome. Mm-hmm. And they were very much medicinal plant gardens at a time when medicine and plant study were very much one and the same science.
So influence of the Renaissance, I suspect. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And they spread from Italy throughout the European capital. So that was a sort of really major driving force. And then with the colonial expansion, then people exploring overseas, then discovering new plant crops, and then introducing crops from one part of the the world to others, and trialing new agricultural crops was a major part of the history of botanic gardens.
Well, the original ones, were they funded by kings and queens or government or private groups, or how do they get started?
Well, very often they were connected with universities, the sponsors of the university would provide the garden as part of that. And then certainly there were royal connections, certainly with the development of Kew. Definitely that was through royal connections.
Mm-hmm. So who are some of the other people that sort of crazy to a certain extent because plant exploration used to be sort of wild and exotic, but who were some of the more famous people behind the movement of botanic gardens?
Well, I think in the UK, the Hookers were really the driving force behind the development of Kew. And also Joseph Banks, who mm-hmm. was a plant collector who traveled with Captain Cook and Charles Darwin. And he served as an advisor to Kew from 1772 until he died in 1820. And this was a time when people were traveling to Australia for the first time and all over the world and bringing back new and interesting plants.
Was there a golden age of collecting, or are we still living through a great impetus on that?
I think it was the Victorian era, mm-hmm. era with the expansion of the beautiful glass houses. I think right. that's when there was a real celebration of the diversity of plants around the world, and that was brought to the attention of the public who could visit these magnificent gardens.
Mm-hmm. So, Sarah, with your work... with the Botanic Gardens Conservation International, are there characters today that are, you know, involved in plant exploration that, you know, we may not know as household names quite yet as plant people, but that you know of that are making significant impacts in terms of plant preservation and conservation?
Oh, yes. I think there's a whole host of people. They're not maybe not household names, mm-hmm. but who've influenced the plant conservation movement very significantly. Obviously, Peter Raven, based at Missouri Botanic Garden,
right.
has had a huge influence
right.
over the years. Mm-hmm. And there are very committed botanists in most parts of the world who are working incredibly hard to conserve plant diversity.
Mm-hmm. I never cease to wonder at some of these plants that have survived primarily because explorers went out and found them 200 years ago and kept them going. It's just really kind of a wonderful chain.
Well, that's the great thing. I mean, we can conserve plants and we can keep them going, but there's such a big job to be done now because there are so many threats on the species in the wild.
Mm-hmm. It seems like science and, you know, to a certain degree, technology, I would imagine, plays a significant role in today's gardens. And as we had mentioned before, not everybody has the resources to do that sort of thing. So is there a cooperation between all of all of these gardens to help out maybe those that don't have facilities, that sort of thing? And is that, in fact, part of what you all do and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. We, Botanic Gardens Conservation International, is a global network of botanic gardens, mm-hmm. and we link some of the major well-known gardens, whether it's Missouri Botanic Garden, Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden in Miami, the mm-hmm. Huntington Botanical Garden in California, New York Botanic Garden, with some of the really under-resourced gardens in parts of Africa and South America, the Caribbean, mm-hmm. India, and we bring people together to exchange ideas, share experiences, and share techniques through workshops, and share information on how to grow plants and how to conserve them. Mm-hmm. So there's a good sense of community amongst the botanic gardens of the world, and I think it's partly that shared commitment to celebrating plants and looking after them.
So, Sarah, have you been to all 60 of the botanic gardens?
Not yet.
Not
but,
yet. How
I'm
many?
Hopeful.
How many?
Actually, there's a lot more. There's about 2,500
okay.
worldwide.
So. for books to come in the future, huh?
Yeah, I'm working on it.
I've been to six of the ones that you've included in the book. So, yeah, I still have quite a few more to go myself.
2,494
Yeah. Well, I must say, in the past, since I joined BGCI 3 years ago, I've been to more botanic gardens than ever before in my life. And it's a wonderful job to do.
I bet it is. So let's highlight some of the ones that you've visited, or maybe not visited, but you know, big and small, that stand out in your mind in some form or fashion, and maybe in a way that kind of gives us a sampling of what's out there.
Okay, well, that's quite
a tough one
to do. There is such a range. I mean, I think some of the gardens that I've mentioned in the States, like Missouri Botanic Garden, I always like going back to
yes.
because there's such a strong research focus there. Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden in Miami is a wonderful, wonderful place to visit because it's such a beautiful site, but also they're doing such good conservation work, working with plants from the Florida Keys, and that's that part of southern Florida. Let me see. I also love the desert botanic gardens. Mm-hmm. The desert botanic garden in Arizona is a really beautiful place to visit, in Phoenix, Arizona. Then in Europe, some of the gardens in Spain, which have got a very strong conservation focus, there's a beautiful botanic garden in the Canary Islands, which is conserving a lot of the endemic species there. Mm-hmm. And I've been lucky enough to visit quite a few botanic gardens in China recently, mm-hmm. where they're doing very good work on the conservation of magnolias and maples and some of the rare trees. So
Sarah, in China, if I would think, but I don't know, do they have a long tradition of botanic gardens, you know, similar
they have a UK? Very ancient tradition, mm-hmm. of gardening, but there was a resurgence. Most of the major botanic gardens with a scientific focus were developed around 50 years ago, and a very strong network of scientific botanic gardens was established then. Mm-hmm. But now there's a real growing interest in new botanic gardens being formed within China, and it's partly to have a prestigious garden within the city, but it's also very, very important for conservation and public education, because China has about 10% of the world's flora, so obviously having a strong botanic garden network is very important.
And Sarah, is it more urgent now than ever if we consider, developing countries and industrialization kind of fast forward in countries where it had not been previously, where populations are very large? Are these things going to threaten plant diversity even more? You know, in the United States and the United Kingdom, perhaps people understand it to a certain degree because we've been talking about it for a long time, but in other places progress may sort of overrule our notions of conservation and preservation.
Well, I think sadly that's very true, and one of the problems is that we have a concentration of botanic gardens in Europe, mm-hmm. with around 500, and in the States with also 300 or 400 botanic gardens, and then some of the global biodiversity hotspots where the needs are greatest for plant conservation, there's not such a strong network of botanic gardens. Mm-hmm. So that international support is very important. Mm-hmm. But also, again, thinking about China, you know, the pace of urbanization and industrialization is so rapid,
right,
that I think the botanic gardens are going to be critical if we want to save plant diversity. Mm-hmm.
So do you all play a role in that at all, like trying to get gardens started in certain places, as you say, that, you know, might be a hotbed of need for collecting and documenting and all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a great sharing of expertise and ideas, and stimulating ideas. For example, through the Global Strategy for Plant Conservation, which is an agreement signed up to at government level, but botanic gardens are doing a lot of the, mm-hmm. delivery work on that. But one of the problems with creating a new botanic garden is that it has to be some inbuilt sustainability. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there's always a worry that the garden will become established, but it then needs quite a lot of maintenance,
right,
and ongoing support.
So a lot of money.
Well, yeah, it has to be self-generating, ideally. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's kind of difficult to kick-start something if you can't be sure it's going to be able to survive.
So have we seen many new gardens in the last decade or so?
Yes, there is the new the garden in Turkey that I mentioned earlier, there's a fabulous new botanic garden in Jordan, the Royal Botanic Garden Jordan, mm-hmm. about 25 kilometers from the capital city, Amman. And that's a beautiful natural area that is partly being maintained as a reserve and partly developed to showcase some of the diversity of Jordan's wild plants, and as an education center. So there has been a steady increase in botanic gardens over the past 50 years, and new ones are being developed, but equally you do get some that go into decline. Mm-hmm. So I think the trend is upwards, but there are some that fall into disrepair.
Sure. All right. I've got six. How many do you have, Bob?
7 1/4.
7 1/4. And I'm hoping, Sarah, that maybe you'll come out with some additional great botanic gardens of the world in the future. Maybe I can tick off a couple of more.
Yeah. Well, they're all great.
They are all great.
Botanic gardens all in their own way do a good job.
I think so as well. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Sarah Oldfield is a botanist and Secretary General of Botanic Gardens Conservation International. She's also the author of Great Botanic Gardens of the World, a look at the work and collections of 60 institutions around the globe. The proceeds of this book go back into Botanic Gardens Conservation International and their efforts to save endangered plants. She spoke to us from their offices on the grounds at Kew. And of course, for more information, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's fabulous plant stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With a couple of questions.
Yep.
And you can ask me first because that's the kind of guy I am.
Okay. How polite.
I am.
This one's from Susan. Hey, Bob and Janine, here's a question for you. Is there anything that can be done about nuts hedge? Last year, I killed out a whole big section of the grass where it was growing, but it's filled in nicely again this summer. And as she says, the despicable bright green blades are back. Plus, it's super duper fast growing. It grows way faster than you can cut it, and then it's already like an inch above your grass the next day. So she's wondering what product will effectively kill nuts hedge.
It's a great product with the same name as a cartoon character ought to be. Sedgehammer.
Sedgehammer. They've just started marketing Manage, which was traditionally the product, under a fabulous new name.
It is a good name.
Sedgehammer.
My weeds are off to those people. Mm-hmm. That's good.
And it really does work.
Yeah, I've not tried it yet, but I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. Just apply it while it's actively growing. You know, you can buy it, I think, in like kind of pre-measured kind of doses. So one application sort of thing in a hose and sprayer or watering can or, you know, whatever you need to do. So
would it work on cardoon?
I don't know. It may kill some herbaceous plants, but it definitely doesn't kill your grass when you're treating your grass with nuts hedge growing in it.
Sedgehammer, folks. That's the answer. A question from Miss Wishy.
Mm-hmm.
It's herb related. I planted 5 sweet basil plants and 1 African blue basil at the same time I usually do each year, which is around the Derby, in the same raised bed from which I've harvested and made tons of pesto last year and before. The plants were watered in and cared for, just as I usually do every year. This woman is following the course here. However, this year I lost all but one of these.
Hmm.
They just wilted and died.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think quite certainly, especially because she plants her basil in the same place every year, Bob.
Right.
It's probably a fungal blight.
Yeah.
It's like a botrytis blight or fusarium type of blight that affects the plant. It's soil borne and it's also seed borne, sort of like that blight that hits peppers. So you can get a plant at the store, and if it was raised from a blighted seed, then it's eventually going to get that fungus. Or the fact that she keeps plants them in the same place every year, it's in the soil. Yeah. So once they get planted and then, you know, water splashes up on the foliage, they get it again. And it's marked by kind of blackening, lesions on the stem, and, you know, sudden wilting. And the recommendation I've always got, if that happens, because it's happened to me before from time to time, as soon as you see it happening, rip it out and dispose of it. Because you don't want to harbor more blight in your garden.
Then don't plant there for a couple of years.
Don't plant there for a couple of years. Find a new spot to plant your basil.
Actually, that's true of almost every plant.
Mm-hmm.
I read just this week in the same vein.
Starve it out.
Some wave petunias were dying in the third year of planting in the same bed. Mm-hmm. And there's a wilt that gets in
something
the soil.
That gets in there too.
And it's going to kill them. And you just have to lay off for 3 or 4 years. So rotate your crops, folks, is the bottom line. You can't plant the same thing staying in the same bed every year.
Yeah. It's no fun either.
That's true.
It's a little boring. But yeah, rotating, whether you're an annual or an herb, is not a bad idea.
If you have an annual or rotating herb question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story week. What do you have for us?
The dove tree.
Oh.
Have you ever seen one?
Yeah, in England.
Aren't they something?
Yeah. When I visited Great Botanic Gardens of the World, in fact. I've never seen one in America. No, actually, Brad Broker has one, doesn't he?
He might, yeah.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, I saw one, and I'm going to grow one again. I saw one either in Arnold Arboretum or the Longwood Gardens. I cannot remember. It's an incredible tree. It's called the handkerchief tree, the ghost tree, the dove tree. It's got big white bracts that look like handkerchiefs.
Mm-hmm, and hanging there.
Yeah, they hang down from the tree and they float down from the tree. Mm. It's really neat. It's a tough sell in this area because it takes 10 years to bloom. And people aren't going to wait 10 minutes in America for something.
And it probably
to bloom.
Doesn't like the heat and humidity. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. It grows in parts of China, but it's hardy to zone 6. I'm going to find out.
I think it's the summers that are hard on it.
I'll still be a kid in 10 years.
Yeah.
The Latin is Davidia involucrata. Davidia is cool. It comes from a French missionary to the Sichuan province of China named Armand David. He first saw the tree, saw the flower, so the Davidia part stuck with him. Involucrata is Latin for wrapper, as in Snoop Doggy
involved.
Dog. No, wrapped around.
Yeah, you're completely involved.
Snoop Doggy Dog.
Wrapped.
You got it. Here's another little known fact. Father David was the first one to see the panda outside of China.
Yeah, I was going to say outside of China. Yeah. I'm sure somebody else saw the pandas first.
Well, he did. When he got back home to France, he started a chain of Chinese restaurants called the Sichuan Pandas with dove trees in the yard.
All right.
You with me on this one?
That's not true.
Okay. Now, he was sent to China in 1869, and he was assigned to teach some kids about natural history and found the seeds, sent them back to France. In 1897, another missionary sent 37 seeds back to France,
One survived.
One out of 37. At the same time, the Vetch Nursery in Britain had heard about the plant, and they sent the young Ernest Wilson, one of the great plant collectors of all time, to find it in 1899. He was ordered to travel 900 miles to the center of China, given a map, one tree, and an area the size of England. Go find the tree. He went there. He got there. He found a stump.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Somebody cut down the tree. Along the way, his boat was wrecked in the rapids. He was in the middle of the Boxer Revolt.
He wasn't the one that got eaten by a Bengal tiger, was he?
He's still alive. And his guide was an opium addict.
Oh.
So other than the fact when he got there, he found a stump. What a trip.
The days of exciting plant exploration.
But he looked around and found another grove, and he took some home with him.
Okay, so he did find some.
Then he found the French had beaten him to it. And it broke his heart because they'd been there years earlier.
Right.
But good news, there was two separate species.
Oh, okay.
So he got.
So everybody got there.
Everybody got their dove tree. It's a great story.
It is a great story.
Get out there and find a tree in the middle of China.
So Davidia.
Involucrata.
Involucrata.
As wrapper.
Right.
Comes with a poem. Of all the wonders you might see, few compare to the handkerchief tree. Imagine its beauty in even rows, or if you have to blow your nose. Without a store for miles around, there's the answer, in the ground. Do so with a nod to Father David, whose road to glory was not so paved by a tree that happened to be there as second fiddle to the panda bear. Still some seeds got home to France, where and how and just by chance, one of 37 sown came to call the country home. All that was lost on the silly Brits, who suffered plant explorer fits. Dispatching Wilson to almost drown with opium addict far from town. So you and I and you and me can hold hands neath the handkerchief tree.
We'll have to go check on Brad's handkerchief tree, see how it's doing.
In 10 years, you can come see mine.
All right. Sounds good. All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, let's see. Sphinx moth turns into a catalpa worm, which is prized by a lot of fishermen.
I saw the movie. Homegrown is produced by the death-defying Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.